Beautiful.
Hello and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on The Wire today...
No, they're not capable of cutting it off. If they are, might be able to achieve for 24 hours, but that's a line that they wouldn't cross because they couldn't sustain it.
Iran seized a British-flagged oil tanker on Friday in the Straits of Hormuz as tensions between the two states threaten world oil prices. Also on the program tonight...
They're all wonderfully articulate young people. They're very good at speaking to people and very good at advocating for the ILF. And I don't think we could be any luckier with the student ambassadors that we have.
A group of young students from across Australia are on a mission to close the gap of Indigenous literacy. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. But first, MasterChef judge and restaurateur George Colombaris has had to back pay his workers $7.8 million in wages, as well as paying a $200,000 contrition payment that many have just dubbed as a slap on the wrist. And now, chef and owner of Rockpool restaurant Empire, Neil Perry, has been accused of paying one of his chefs, who allegedly worked 70 hours a week, just $12 an hour. Michaela Savage investigated what this means for hospitality workers.
The hospitality industry is a notoriously underpaid one, with many workers exploited for their labour. Josh used to be a waiter at a restaurant in the Blue Mountains.
And my boss there once took me outside to the side of the restaurant, like on an alleyway where people are walking through, and he berated me for so long, told me that I was going to fail at uni because my work ethic was so poor, and like told me that I'm lucky that the minimum wage is what it is because if he had it his way, he'd only pay me half that much because I only do half the job. And then I quit that day. I have had jobs in the past where I haven't had pay slips from my bosses because they said that they like can't do it.
And Ben is currently a waiter at a pub where his managers treat him well, but that hasn't always been the case in his previous hospitality jobs.
There'd often be a very lack of consistent shifts and it could kind of be all over the place. It's not a very secure industry a lot of the time. Yeah, I mean, like, I'm pretty knackered by the end of the shift and my muscles kind of ache, my feet are a bit sore. But as a whole, I definitely feel like given the sacrifices you kind of make working in hospitality, penalty rates being one of them, for example, it would make sense to pay hospitality staff a bit more, absolutely.
And now, with the high-profile cases of George Colombaris and now Neil Perry accused of severely underpaying their workers, the issue is under the spotlight. Mark Morey, Secretary of Unions New South Wales, says that the $7.8 million in back pay that George Colombaris has had to pay is due to an unacceptable systematic error.
If I go into a restaurant and I steal the tip jar on the counter, I get charged with theft and potentially go to jail. These cases show that people have stolen from workers and it's basically a slap on the wrist. In fact, you've got the Fair Work Ombudsman as part of the penalties asking this guy to make movies for them. I mean, it's just outrageous.
He says there's no excuse for the government not to prosecute these offences.
If you break the tax law, you are charged. And we have accounts to make sure that businesses pay the right tax. This is not an error. This is actually a systematic decision not to pay people properly, and it should be prosecuted. We actually need people to be paid the correct rate of pay. And particularly when you've got the Reserve Bank saying we want wage growth, we want proper wages and conditions, that whole industry, the restaurant and catering industry, hospitality, needs to step up and actually take a leadership role.
Helping hospitality workers do this is HospoVoice, a union for hospitality workers by hospitality workers. HospoVoice ran a petition on megaphone.org to remove George Colombaris as a judge on Channel 10's MasterChef, which got up to 10,000 signatures in the first day it was up and now has up to 22,000 signatures. James Masden-Smith is a HospoVoice leader.
Well, it makes no sense. I mean, it defies logic that you would place someone on a pedestal who's systematically broken the law and exploited workers, that's who they choose to be holding up as this kind of ideal for the industry to strive for. He shouldn't have that kind of public platform and profile.
The union also supports a boycott of the two chefs' restaurants.
I think that's the best way to kind of make a difference, is if other people in the industry can see that it's just bad business to be exploiting workers, which at the moment it's the complete opposite. You know, it's clearly a very profitable thing for these chefs to be doing.
And needless to say, he told me Hospo Voice is not satisfied with the outcome of George Colombaris's case.
Not at all. And I think what it's shone a light on is just how inadequate the system's in place to deal with this kind of breaches of the law are, that they're set up ultimately in the favour of the employers instead of the employees who are being exploited. It's ridiculous. It's pretty outrageous. And the fact that we're now looking at high-profile, very wealthy chefs who are systematically making a business model out of not paying staff is, you know, just another level up from a lot of the exploitation that we have dealt with so far in the industry.
Mark Morey from Unions New South Wales agrees.
There's a catch-us-if-you-can mentality. And if you're only going to have a slap on the wrist when people substantially and systematically break the law, then it's saying, we're not going to pursue you. And that is a very bad message being sent by both the government and the regulators. It basically says that we now have an institutionalised secondary labour market where business models are based on exploitation, and that's how people are making profits, by underpaying workers in order to make their businesses profitable. And it's just, it shouldn't be done, it can't be let go, and governments have tacitly endorsed it over the last couple of years.
But if you're a hospitality worker and you think you're being exploited or underpaid, the unions say don't let it slide.
You should join your union, Hospo Voice. We're here to advocate collectively in trying to promote our shared interests. You should get together with the other workers in your workplace, collect time slips, proof of the underpayment, and take concerted action as a workplace. So report them to the Fair Work Ombudsman, and be working together as a staff base is the key thing.
James Mazden-Smith, leader at Hospo Voice, ending that report by Michaela Savage. Children's literacy levels are always a concern in Australia, but when it comes to Indigenous children, there is still a gap that needs to be closed. It's worse in remote communities, where often appropriate reading materials are just not available. However, there is a group of talented school children who are ambassadors for the Indigenous Literary Foundation who are working to close the gap. And I spoke with their mentor, 19-year-old Lachlan Coleman, who himself was an ambassador in Year 6.
So I first came into contact with the Indigenous Literacy Foundation when I was 11 in Year 6. I had developed a relationship with a remote Indigenous community called Juntunjara, which is in the Great Victoria Desert. And after a while, I was invited to visit the community. And so with the help of the Indigenous Literacy Foundation, I was able to raise money and provide three huge boxes of beautiful books for the community library, which was very well received. And it was a fantastic, fantastic trip.
Now, tell us a bit about the Indigenous Literary Foundation itself. How is it helping Indigenous kids?
So the Indigenous Literacy Foundation is a not-for-profit organisation and it receives no government funding whatsoever. And essentially, the central aim of the foundation is to help close the gap in Indigenous literacy levels in Australia. And it might shock many of your listeners to hear that Year 5 students, Indigenous students in very remote communities, in the Northern Territory, only 18% of them reach the minimum literacy standard, whereas their non-Indigenous urban counterparts, 96% of them reach the minimum literacy standard. So there's a clear divide between Indigenous and non-Indigenous students in Australia and location, so isolation has a lot to do with it. So the ILF, through its numerous programs, aims to help close that gap, mainly by providing books and resources to the communities, but also by running community literacy programs, which involve writing, workshops and publication of local stories.
And you've got a number of ambassadors, which I presume are from all over Australia, are they?
Yeah, so we're fortunate this year to have our second year of the Student Ambassador Program, and we have 7 students from around Australia. I think we cover 3 states, and we have Indigenous and non-Indigenous student ambassadors, which is wonderful as well. They're aged between Year 6 to Year 12, so we have quite a wide range of students, and it's really wonderful because essentially they are assisting the Indigenous Literacy Foundation in closing the gap between non-Indigenous and Indigenous students from the students' perspective. And it's great to have students supporting students.
Right. So they'd take particular area or particular schools, or how does it work in the way that they interact?
Well, the students represent their schools first and foremost, but also act as ambassadors for the community. So a few key roles that they have is to help raise awareness and funds in their own schools, but also to reach out to schools in their local community. And that can also include public libraries, sporting clubs, local businesses and workplaces. And their role is to provide a young face for the Indigenous Literacy Foundation and help spread the message as much as we can to as many people as we can.
So, I mean, that's no small feat in itself to be able to talk to all these different groups and people, because, you know, public speaking isn't easy, is it?
No, it's certainly not easy, and it's certainly something that you learn over time. But I've been blown away by the student ambassadors that we have. They're all wonderfully articulate young people. They're very good at speaking to people and very good at advocating for the ILF. And I don't think we could be any luckier with the student ambassadors that we have.
And do you find that you get to people and they haven't picked up a book, they haven't read a book all the way through or something, and then they get to that moment where they're actually enjoying it? What does that feel like?
It's wonderful. It reminds me of a time when I was in Junjunjara with the Indigenous Literacy Foundation, so a few years after my first visit, and the ILF had come along with some books for the community, and we had this wonderful evening under the stars in the school, and we'd made up some food and some fire pits in the schoolyard, and basically everyone was sitting around reading books and enjoying them, and it was a wonderful event because many Indigenous people don't have books in their home, and the first time people come into contact with books is actually at school. So these students were able to bring books home, show them to their parents and to their families, and enjoy the gift of reading all together. And it was really a wonderful event. It was just the collection of a community enjoying literacy, and it was fantastic.
And Lockie, tell us a bit about the event that you're having on the 4th of September.
So the major fundraising event that the Indigenous Literacy Foundation runs is called the Great Book Swap. And that occurs on Indigenous Literacy Day, which this year is on the 4th of September. And all you have to do is bring along a book and a gold coin donation for the ILF and swap your book with someone else's. And that way you can make a donation to the foundation, you can pass on the love of a book that you've already enjoyed, and also take home a new book to read and enjoy. So it's a wonderful event. We'd encourage as many people as possible to run one in their own communities. And Indigenous Literacy Day is on the 4th of September. So you can hold your great books up on that day or any other day, but we'd really love to have your support.
Yeah, Lachlan Coleman, mentor for the Young Ambassadors for the Indigenous Literary Foundation, speaking with me there. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to The Wire around Australia on the Community Radio Network. On Friday, Irani Revolutionary Guards stormed a British tanker off the Strait of Hormuz in what British government sources describe as a key escalation of tension between the nations. Many see this as a direct response to US-led sanctions against Iran's major industries in response to the continuation of the Middle East and the nation's uranium enrichment plan. Max Tillman has the story.
You'll be safe. If you obey, you will be safe.
To the untrained eye, it would have looked like something straight out of an action film. Last Friday, elite members of Iran's Revolutionary Guard rappelled from helicopters onto the deck of British-flagged oil tanker the Snena Impero in the Straits of Hormuz, the latest in a tit-for-tat of highly dramatic tensions since the British Royal Navy impounded an Iranian oil tanker destined for Syria on July 4th. Professor Roger Shanahan, a senior researcher from the Lowry Institute, sees Iran's actions in the Straits as a strike on the bottom line of the international shipping trade, as retaliation for sanctions imposed against Iran in 2018 for continuing its uranium enrichment program.
What we're seeing is they're trying to raise the economic costs to a range of actors. You can see there's a spike in the oil price when there's an incident in the Straits of Hormuz, but you know, it levels out after a relatively short period of time. But what doesn't level out are insurance costs for tankers, people choosing where to refuel, for instance, so they're avoiding the UAE and refueling further out. So there's an economic cost that is being imposed by the Iranians by interfering with some of the Gulf maritime trade, and certainly that's one of the points that the Iranians are trying to achieve, is to raise the costs to other people in the same way that costs have been raised against them.
The Straits of Hormuz provide the only sea passage from the Persian Gulf to the open ocean and are a vital choke point for the global economy, with a third of the world's liquefied natural gas and almost 20% of global oil consumption passing through its narrow waters. In 2011, Iranian Vice President Mohammad Reza Rahimi threatened to cut off oil supplies from the Straits should economic sanctions limit or cut off Iranian oil exports. To Professor Shanahan, these threats of embargo are clear rhetoric.
No, they're not capable of cutting it off. If they are, might be able to achieve for 24 hours, but that's a line that they wouldn't cross because they couldn't sustain it and because they know that would galvanise the international community against them. They'd be in breach of all international maritime law. They couldn't practically do it for any length of time, and the cost to them of doing it would be exorbitant.
But for such an important waterway, what are the rules that govern safe passage? And does Iran have a justifiable cause for forcibly boarding a British-flagged commercial vessel? Associate Professor David Letts is the director of the Military Law Program at the Australian National University.
First of all, Iran has signed but has not ratified the 1982 Law of the Sea Convention. The flag state, the United Kingdom, Britain, they are party to the 1982 Law of the Sea Convention. The passage regime that's available to all ships is what's known as transit passage, and it was introduced into the 1982 Convention to safeguard the continuous and expeditious passage of vessels through straits such as Hormuz. And there's a requirement under the convention that there shall be no suspension of transit passage. That's one of the duties that rests with those states that border these types of straits.
Now, while the Convention on the Law of the Sea makes clear that unimpeded passage for commercial vessels is an inalienable condition, Professor Letts makes clear that even though Iran has not ratified the convention, vessels are still obliged to obey their laws when passing through or adjacent to their territorial waters.
There's a requirement on foreign ships to comply with any laws that a state like Iran has, but that's really about where it gets to in terms of specifically referring to what action a bordering state can take. The convention doesn't contemplate seizure of a vessel in the way that Iran appears to have done.
So what happens now? Well, as made clear by both Dr. Shanahan and Professor Letts, much of the rhetoric being fired from Tehran to London and vice versa is a matter of sovereign pride. Whilst the Straits are clearly within striking distance of Iran's military force, a closure of one of the world's largest trade routes would be too great a burden to bear for a government already dealing with crippling political and economic sanctions that have targeted some of the nation's key industries, including shipbuilding and commercial shipping. For the British, it raises the question of how comprehensive the Royal Navy's response to protecting British interests in the future should be. Whilst the Royal Navy has been in gradual recession since the end of the Second World War, will the Straits of Hormuz be the catalyst for a new age arms race as oil prices become the tinderbox?
Max Tillman there, ending that report. Phil Grabsky is a filmmaker who uses the latest film techniques to bring the great artists and their artworks to life in his latest film series. Following the success of his film on Degas, at the beginning of August, cinemas throughout Australia will be showing The Passion of Picasso, with particular emphasis on his formative years as a young man. I spoke with Phil Grabsky to find out what drove Picasso in his long, incredible career as an artist.
What's interesting about Picasso, and you know, he's one of the arguably the greatest artist of the 20th century, probably the best known name. He has the most exhibitions around the world every year of any artist. It's quite something. What interested me is, where does he come from? Why this little boy from Malaga? And actually what you discover is that, you know, very early on, partly because of his father, who was an artist and an art teacher, he studies ferociously all the artists of the past, all the artists, you know, all his contemporaries, artists slightly older than him, So actually, initially in Spain, when he's in Madrid, he goes and he studies and he copies Velázquez and El Greco and Murillo and people like that, Goya. When he gets to Barcelona, wonderful city to be in, he's influenced by the Catalan painters of the time. And then in 1900, when he goes to Paris, which is the place to be, he's still only a teenager. That's when he meets the Impressionists. That's when he starts copying them. And he, you know, we show in the film paintings where he's you can see he's copying Van Gogh, you can see he's copying Toulouse-Lautrec. But all of this is just in a desire to really understand the craft of painting. That he's not really following one style or the other. And it's not until a couple of years later with the Blue Period, so-called Blue Period, when he really bursts forth with his own style. He's calling himself Picasso at this point. He dropped the other part of his name, which was Ruiz, which is a bit like Smith or Jones. You know, he dropped that. He just became Picasso. And then we go a couple of years more in the film up to 1907 when he creates one of the most remarkable paintings of the 20th century. And from that moment on, he is genuinely, you know, he's made a mark for himself. He has already become the beginning of the great Picasso that then lives for another 50 years.
Are you talking about the Guernica there?
No, actually, the painting is called Les Demoiselles d'Avignon.
I was going to say it because I think that's from a different period.
I mean, just to show the longevity of the man, Guernica is almost 30 years after that, when we're, you know, the beginning of the Spanish Civil War. And then he lives another 20-odd years beyond that. I mean, it's an extraordinary life. But, you know, people have this perception of him as the older man, with the balding hair and the girlfriends and the wives and the certain type of painting style. What I'm looking at is this young, fresh, full head of hair, young Spaniard, doesn't speak French when he first goes to Paris, and, you know, this ferocity of passion to be the best that he could possibly be as an artist. And he's just kind of, he's like a magpie. He's stealing everybody. He's learning from everyone. And then he bursts forth. And this painting, Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, initially, even his avant-garde friends thought it was a disaster. And he was so embarrassed by it, really. He put it away for 10 years. And then it was shown again in the First World War where it made a bit of a stir. And then, particularly when it was bought and showed by MoMA in New York in the late 30s, and it's barely been off their walls for the last, 80 years.
And can you still call that part of the Impressionist time, or is it something else in there?
No, we've left Impressionism behind now, and this painting, Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, is the beginning of what's known as Cubism. And what Cubism is, you know, don't be afraid of these ism terms. Basically, the Impressionism that you refer to, wasn't a term really that those artists liked very much. They considered themselves the Society of Independent Artists. And this term Impressionism was thrown at them by one critic commenting on a painting by Monet called Sunrise Impression, or Impression Sunrise. But in a sense, what Impressionism is the attempt to capture the fleeting effects of light.
And, of course, it's what has driven Picasso when he was young. And I've seen a lot of pictures of him when he was older, and I'm just trying to think. I can't picture in my mind what he was like when he was young.
I mean, it's one of the things I like doing with all these artists. I mean, whether it was great composers, Mozart, Beethoven, Chopin, Haydn, four films that we're releasing again later this year and into next year, all these artists, the first 25 years, in fact, even the first 20 years, are absolutely formative. And in many cases, pretty much the individual is formed by the time they're into their early 20s. Now, they are difficult periods of a life to cover because no one, you know, early on in your life, you're not being written about quite so much. But actually, they're the interesting years to look at. Why this young boy from Malaga? You know, where did Rembrandt learn his craft? How does Van Gogh become the artist that we know? Now, I'm fortunate with Picasso because there are photographs. And, you know, the very poster is this young, extremely attractive Spanish guy, full head of hair, piercing eyes. And you can see why they were drawn to him.
Filmmaker Phil Grabsky speaking with me there about Picasso, the passion. And that's about it for us here at The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au, or you can subscribe to our podcast on your smartphone. I'm going to be back again tomorrow, so please do tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney. The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation. I'm Roderick Chambers. Thanks for your company.
We could end